Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, separating fact from fiction, setting the record straight on New York's climate law, we speak to Rich Schrader of the NRDC about the fossil fuel industry's opposition to New York's Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Schrader says it's New York State's chance for a cleaner, healthier future. Sullivan County is looking for aspiring educators to ignite their passion for teaching. We speak to Dr. Robert DeFour from Sullivan County BOCES about the initiative. And Choi Commons is a Hudson Valley-based cooperative of Asian-led farms, growing ancestral foods, gathering the community in cultural practice, and providing food for communities in need. Plus, the Liberty Library wants to help you get your own garden growing. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. CIA Director William Burns has met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. The talks are part of an effort to secure a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. The Israeli military has reopened a border crossing from Egypt into Gaza that had been closed for 3 days. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Tel Aviv.
The Kerem Shalom crossing is where U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited last week, heralding the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. But within days, a Hamas rocket attack killed 4 Israeli soldiers nearby, and Israel closed the border to aid deliveries. Now it says it's reopened. Meanwhile, an Israeli tank brigade has seized another crossing between Gaza and Egypt, and sporadic explosions and gunfire has been heard around it. The U.N. is demanding its aid vehicles nevertheless be allowed through. The Rafah crossing is the only crossing where aid workers and fuel trucks can go into Gaza and injured people can come out. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The U.S. is pausing deliveries of a substantial number of bombs to Israel. The Biden administration is concerned these will be used in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering there with no other place to go. In the U.S., police in several areas have taken action against pro-Palestinian demonstrators on college campuses. That includes George Washington University in Washington, D.C. From member station WAMU, Tyrone Turner says 33 people have been arrested today.
I talked to 3 people who said they were medics in the encampment, and they said that a little after 3 o'clock in the morning, there was a lot of activity. They had police coming through. They had people on bullhorns saying that they were clearing the encampment. And then it was a little bit of confusion, and they had some people who stayed, some people who left, and then they had arrests.
Tyrone Turner reporting. Washington, D.C.'s mayor and police chief were set to testify on Capitol Hill today about their response to campus protests. That hearing has now been canceled. Stocks continue to open mixed this morning as housing costs continue to climb. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 9 points in early trading.
The National Association of Realtors says home prices are rising throughout the United States. 93% of metro areas saw a price increase in the first quarter, including 30% where prices rose by double digits. A shortage of homes for sale is keeping prices up. Despite today's high mortgage rates, the average rate on a 30-year home loan is just under 7.25%. Crude oil prices continue to slide. The U.S. benchmark price is down about 10% over the last month. Retail gasoline prices held steady overnight. Anaheim City Council has given a green light to the first big changes in decades at Disneyland. The nearly $2 billion plan calls for adding new rides on an old parking lot.
NPR's Scott Horsley. This is NPR. The National Weather Service says it got dozens of reports of tornadoes yesterday. These ranged from Arkansas to Michigan. Michigan's governor has declared a state of emergency in 4 counties, citing strong damage and injuries to several people. A new survey finds people in the United States are increasingly divided by party over the issues of NATO and Ukraine. NPR's Frank Langford has more on the findings from the Pew Research Center report.
3/4 of Democrats and Democrat-leaning independents view NATO favorably as the military alliance celebrates its 75th birthday this year. But only 43% of Republicans and those who lean Republican agree. That's a drop of 8 percentage points in about 2 years. The division over NATO mirrors attitudes towards Ukraine. About half of Republicans say the U.S. is providing too much support to the embattled country, 3 times more than Democrats. The survey of 3,600 adults was conducted before President Biden signed a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine last month. The survey also found that more than half of respondents think American influence is weakening, while more than 70% think China's influence is getting stronger. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
The 68th annual Eurovision Song Contest has now opened in Sweden. This week's events will cut the international field of musicians down to 26. These musicians will advance to Saturday's final. Tens of thousands of Eurovision fans are in Sweden this week. So are many pro-Palestinian protesters. They'll demonstrate against the war in Gaza tomorrow and on Saturday. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Monrovia, growing plants for nearly 100 years. Monrovia grows a diverse selection of shrubs, trees, perennials, and more for different climate and landscape needs, from hydrangeas to lavenders. Monrovia.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Scientists around the globe agree that the burning of coal, gas, and oil produces greenhouse gases that are dangerously heating up the planet. Last year was the hottest on record, and the summer of 2024 is predicted to be a scorcher, too. That's where New York's landmark climate law, the 2019 Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, or also known as CLCPA, comes into play. The CLCPA has set rigorous emissions targets to lessen the amount of climate warming pollution in the atmosphere, but 5 years after the CLCPA passed in 2019, its opponents still haven't given up trying to undermine it. In his new blog for the National Resources Defense Council, Rich Schrader, NRDC's Director of New York Government Affairs, writes that the fossil fuel industry continues to use misinformation to block New York State from achieving its climate goals. The NRDC's Rich Schrader joins us now with more. Good morning.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. And let's remind folks about those rigorous emissions targets that the CLCPA has set for New York State.
Yeah, you know, the climate law, which was passed in 2019, it's a landmark bill. And in New York State, there's many, many parts to it, but the three main ones are that by 2030, which is just around the corner, New York State has to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 40%, and then by 85% by 2050. It seems far away, but of course, we all know time flies. And importantly, there's also standards set in terms of getting renewables, like 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind put in by 2035, and 10,000 megawatts of solar also by 2030. So these are substantial goals, important. Listen, we all know, everyone who's paying attention with eyes to see, that the climate crisis is here, right? We're seeing the escalation of flooding, heat waves, drought. I mean, anyone in the Northeast woke up last summer and saw those, you know, Blade Runner red skies that were coming from the wildfires in Quebec, not even in our country, you know, across the border. And it was scary. The air quality was terrible. Yet it's the fossil fuel industry mostly that's trying to fight back or delay these important renewable investments, as well as a variety of other important environmental laws. You know, the Business Council earlier this year said they were going to raise $1 million, not to defeat, but basically to delay, in their words, to make more reasonable the climate law's goals. We've seen the New Yorkers for Affordable Energy, which is basically a bunch of oil and gas companies and some pipelines. They've spent an enormous amount of money to defeat a series of bills, most of which have passed, including a mandate for all electric buildings in new construction, where electric heat is cheaper than gas heat, and quite a bit cheaper than propane heat. So we're flying in the face, really, the industry flies in the face of the realities of climate change, but still spends lots of money. Yeah, we know they've spent over $15 million in lobbying against these legislation and bills since 2016, you know, 7 years ago, really. And look, these are really costly problems that we're facing globally, nationally, and in New York. The U.S. has seen about $2.5 trillion in losses that are climate-related in the last quarter of a century, 30 years. But New York, just in 2023, had 28 separate billion-dollar weather and climate-related disaster events, which is a term of art by the federal government, 28 of them. And those in 23 alone cost almost $93 billion. So it's enormous amount of property and building damage, enormous amount of damage in terms of coastline. We've got to really start to fade out fossil fuel and bring in more and more renewables.
I don't think it will come to a surprise as anyone that the fossil fuel industry has lobbied against the transition to renewables and solar, wind, hydropower, and electric all over the world, including New York State. But in your blog at nrdc.org, you write that the folks in New York State specifically are somehow on one side of it sort of embracing a push to the green economy, but at the same time spreading some misinformation. Can you talk about this front group that they've created and some of the misinformation that's out there about the climate law in New York State?
Oh, yeah, happy to, Tim. Look, the New Yorkers for Affordable Energy is the group I just cited. That's the main one. And it's really, it's the American Petroleum Institute, which is the national coalition of oil and gas companies. And it's big oil as well. But it's also pipelines like Williams Pipeline. And there's a number of gas companies like National Grid and National Fuel, which is all gas utility up in Western New York. And, you know, they come at you with three main issues that I believe are really inaccurate and in some cases lean towards disinformation. One of them is that it's going to be so much more expensive, renewables. And the fact of the matter is, as I cited, doing nothing is extraordinarily expensive. $92 billion worth of damages in New York State for climate related disasters. Two, it's untrue in terms of the bill that was passed last year, which is going to mandate that all new buildings have all electric heat. Electric heat in new buildings is cheaper, and we have good, strong numbers on that, than gas or propane. It's increasingly cheaper as well. It's also becoming more and more competitive. Gas prices fluctuate all over the place, and we're dependent on gas and oil prices with both foreign dictators like Saudi Arabia, but also if you have seen recent news in the last week, the Federal Trade Commission found that a group of American oil companies had purposely conspired with OPEC to lower production and raise oil costs in 2020 and contributed over 25% of the worst inflation that we saw in 2021 and 2022. So it's not even a question of these costs in terms of what the inherent cost is for fossil fuel. They can manipulate prices, and the Federal Trade Commission is finding them and found also some very substantial charges against American oil companies that conspired with OPEC. And I would say the last piece of this is they're telling you they're going to come and take your gas stove away. Mm-hmm. Trust me, there's nobody from the deep state going to come into your home and take your gas stove away in existing homes. That mandate was only for new construction for electric heat. But gas stoves have health issues, and we've known this for decades. But increasingly, we know more and more about it. In fact, recent reports just in the last week about some of the emissions coming out of your gas stove, like nitrogen dioxide, have very specific and absolute links to childhood asthma. So one of the things that we could be looking at is to put public health warning labels on gas stoves as you buy them at the point of purchase. But it's not about taking your gas stove, pulling it out of your kitchen. It's about knowing what the public health issues are there as well.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Rich Schrader. He's the director of New York Government Affairs for the National Resources Defense Council. We're talking about his recent blog on the NRDC.org website, Separating Fact from Fiction, Setting the Record Straight on New York's Climate Law. You outline these claims in the blog, and we've mentioned a couple of them, including the sort of absurd gas stove being taken away from you, misleading information. Also a claim that there's going to be an adverse impact on the state's overall economic climate that will discourage new investments and job growth if the CLCPA is fully enacted. What's the fact there?
Yeah, you know, you get where the oil gas industry is coming from, right? They see this as the end of their existence. It's an existential threat. One thing we ought to be clear about, though, this doesn't happen overnight. This is a planned transition. It's going to be planned over a period of time. And it's not just going to be 1 year or 2 years. We're looking at a period of time where this transition moves away from fossil fuels, from gas and oil towards electricity that's generated by wind, by solar, by hydropower. Energy efficiency is of great importance. By the way, each of all of those pieces have been opposed by the fossil fuel industry. They could be investing in those renewables and making money at it. But instead of investing in it in any substantial way, they're attacking and trying to undermine it. The truth is that clean energy is going to be good for the environment as we see it kick in and as the investments get stronger and stronger. We already have in New York State almost 200,000 workers who work for what you would call green energy, whether it's from people who are installing solar collectors, whether it's people installing energy efficiency, which is one of the biggest, most labor-intensive of all of these companies and industries, or whether it's the all unionized workforce that puts up offshore wind, which is really a long, strong investment. And those are costly. It's not going to be cheap. But in the end of the day, over time, it's going to be cheaper than fossil fuel is. So it's actually over time stronger for the economy, will create more jobs. There was one report I saw we're going to need in the country over 1 million new plumbers and electricians. So the workforce that's already in existence will be a workforce that's actually going to be enhanced, and it'll be enhanced in terms of skills, but also enhanced in terms of numbers, more people getting the opportunity to have those jobs, not just in New York, but across the country.
More of the efforts to talk about more of the efforts of the fossil fuel industry trying to block New York State from achieving its climate goals. You also mentioned that it's having an impact on the New York Heat Act, which was left out of the fiscal 2025 state budget. Now, why was that? Well, in part, I guess, not completely, but what was some of that misinformation that the fossil fuel industry used to block it? And is there any chance that in the last weeks of the legislative session, it could be put back in?
Yeah, well, I believe there is a chance, and there's a lot of ongoing discussion, and I think it's both instructive and favorable that we're having a discussion about New York Heat, as we're about a month away from the end of the session. Quickly, New York Heat, it takes away a $200 million subsidy that gas companies get whenever they hook up a new customer. We all pay for that in our rate base. We shouldn't. It should never have been a law anyway, but it certainly not does make any sense now. We don't want to be expanding the gas industry's infrastructure, and that's $200 million a year taken out of our pocket. The other piece of it is it puts some real restraints via regulatory action on how much new pipelines those utilities, grid, national fuel can lay down. Costly, expensive, they get a rate of return, in other words, a profit on it, they get great tax depreciations. We're also moving forward where we want to do more, we want to do less and less of that and look more and more at alternatives, you know, like heat pumps and electric heat. What they said was that New York Heat would allow utilities in the worst, coldest winter nights to shut off consumers, who would be put in enormous public safety risk if it was shut off. It's certainly not true. And it's simply just disinformation. You know, the reality is we're going to see issues around cost and there are going to be some competition here. Over time, though, heat pumps will also be extremely competitive. And already in new buildings, they're cheaper. But there's no way that you're going to see a utility shut somebody off in the middle of the night because of New York Heat. There are public service laws that are already in existence that protect consumers from that kind of shutoff. Those are things that many of us have worked on for decades in New York State and nationally. So that's just an absurdity. And that was one of the main reasons I think New York Heat was pushed aside towards the end of the budget discussions, because there was some misinformation and legislators and others, the public was concerned about it. But it ain't going to happen. No one's going to get their heat shut off because of New York Heat. It's going to actually be more reliable, and it's also a way in the long run to start curbing some of these enormous gas utility increases. The rate increases have been extraordinary from National Grid and National Fuel and Con Ed.
One of the groups that was opposing New York Heat is National Fuel, the Western New York-based gas utility. They lobbied hard against this legislation, this act, and also lobbying hard against the state's climate plans. They've spent a lot of money on lobbyists in Albany. What is it specifically about National Fuel that has them so focused on making this not happen or slow down?
Yeah, I don't think it's any more complicated than National Fuels is really gas only. You know, that's the basis of all their sales and their business. They don't see electricity as an alternative because they don't have the investments there. You know, Con Ed and to a lesser degree National Grid, they have alternative business models that they can fall back on. Con Ed certainly sees itself in the future as an all-electric utility only. So they tend to look at these things in a much more balanced way. National Fuel does not and won't, right? This is who they are. They're a fuel company. They also still do some drilling. So yeah, this is part of what they see themselves in terms of their business model and their enterprise. And that's exactly what we have to combat, is that disinformation, right? The future with our climate act, with the climate crisis we're facing, is going to be in alternative renewables, and it's going to be looking at ways that we can get off fossil fuels, which are burning down the planet. Again, not tomorrow, but an orderly transition away from the fossil fuel industry in all the areas, transportation in terms of building and heat, and also in terms of the power sector and how electricity gets generated. We want to be moving towards an all-electric goal in the next 20 years.
Two other major gas utilities in New York, Avangrid, who own NYSEG, and Central Hudson, did not respond to repeated inquiries about the HEAT Act from New York Focus. That's one of our news partners. And neither of those gas utilities has publicly weighed in on the legislation this year. Do you think that the Assembly can get this in, though, to the budget? I'm not sure if you touched on that.
Yeah, no, and that's a fair question. We only have till June 6th. So June 6th, the last day of the session, we don't have a lot of time. Part is because of the lateness of the budget, which, it's understandable. It's beyond a lot of our control. But also part of it is disinformation, as we've been talking about, from the industry. And a third piece of this is clearly that, we have to get the word out there that this is disinformation. And it's tough to compete against, $15 million is being spent in lobbying fees by the industry. But there's a strong campaign, there's a strong and determined group of community groups, public health groups, environmentalists, and other organizations that are out there trying to get the real information across. I think we got a shot at getting this thing passed this session, and we're going to work very hard to get it done. We can't wait much longer. We want to get these pieces in place so that the Public Service Commission under this law can have the authority to really direct more and more in terms of investments from utilities. And also, we want to get rid of that $200 million subsidy the gas industry gets.
As you said at the beginning, 2030 is just around the corner. And you've got this almost institutionalized opposition from the fossil fuel industry against any kind of transition. What can folks do besides, not being fooled and being informed? Is there any action that folks could take that you can recommend?
Yeah, no, I think the main action is, if you have a couple of minutes, just look at the websites of NRDC or the Better Buildings New York. And send an email to leadership in both houses and to the governor. The governor's been very supportive for the most part. So is the state Senate. The Assembly's been the tougher piece. But I think all three, the governor, the majority leader of the state Senate, Stuart Cousins, and Speaker Carl Hastie, send an email supporting New York Heat. And also in that same email, say, support climate action. We need to have a strong stand in New York in terms of moving away from the fossil fuel industry and towards renewables and protecting our climate.
Yep, there's still a little time. Legislatures are scheduled to depart Albany June 6th. Rich Schrader is the NRDC's Director of New York Government Affairs, and you can read his blog at the website nrdc.org. Rich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tim. Take care.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, are you passionate about making a difference in young lives? Do you have a desire to inspire and educate the next generation? Sullivan County is putting out a call for teachers who may have never thought about a career in the classroom. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the exotic sounds of Skip Heller's Voodoo 5, Cocktail Inn, and The Twist Goes Latin. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Mid-Hudson School Study Council, along with Mount St. Mary College and Sullivan BOCES, are inviting aspiring educators to consider a career in teaching in Sullivan County. And they're focusing on folks who may already have college credits or a degree in another field and might be contemplating a career change and think teaching could be their calling. I spoke to Dr. Robert DeFore, District Superintendent and CEO of Sullivan BOCES, about the recruitment initiative.
We have a shortage of teachers, not only in Sullivan County, but throughout New York State as well. The number of young men and women currently enrolled in our teacher prep programs has dropped by almost 50% in the past 5 to 10 years. So we're really scrambling to get qualified individuals into our classrooms to support our students. So that's led to us trying to think outside the box, other ways of trying to recruit individuals. So one of the concepts that we had touched on in connection with our partners at the Mid-Hudson School Study Council and also at Mount St. Mary College is there's a lot of individuals living in our communities who have college degrees, whether they be associate's degrees, bachelor degrees, or even master's degrees, that may not be using them and who may have thought about giving teaching a try. So we wanted to do and reach out to those individuals in our communities who may want to be a teacher, but never had the opportunity to really look into it and may have some underlying credentials to give them a jump start in a teacher prep program. So this is kind of a homegrown effort to see if we can get people living in our communities who have college degrees to put them to work for the kids in our communities and thinking about becoming a teacher.
And it's a great idea to try to tap into those folks who may not think of teaching as the profession that they were necessarily going into, but have some skills that could definitely benefit the teaching profession themselves and students. How does this program work? You put a call out for aspiring educators. What are the steps to this?
So it's a two-step process. We're holding an information session here at Sullivan BOCES on June 4th at 5 p.m. And the address for that is Sullivan BOCES, 15 Sullivan Avenue, up here in Liberty, New York. If an individual thinks they'd like to get more information, we've put out a QR code, which allows them to not only register for the information session, but links them to a survey where they can provide us with some more detail on them, their aspirations, and their background. And what we're hoping to do is prior to the information session, Mount St. Mary is going to review the credentials of those who have expressed interest to try to help and custom tailor a program for each individual who's going to attend the information session.
And, I've seen some of the other programs or other attempts at trying to reduce the teacher shortage across New York. I think I saw something in Monroe County recently in the fall where they came together for a teacher's residency. Do you think that these types of, as you call it, homegrown ideas and programs will help meet this really big demand for new teachers in the next decade?
Is it going to solve the problem? No. Can it help us? Absolutely. We have worked on another project with the Mid-Hudson School Study Council called Homegrown Sullivan. And it was an effort to recruit individuals in our schools in Sullivan County to become administrators. And that cohort is just due to graduate this May. And I believe there's 18 students in that cohort who currently work as teachers in our school districts who will now be certified to be school administrators. So we've done this before with some success. Tim, we just put this flyer out, gave it a shot, see what would happen. Put the information out last Thursday. We've already got 16 interested parties.
That's fantastic.
And it's only 4 days into it.
Well, that's fantastic. I guess that goes to show that there are those folks out there that are now understanding that they could connect in that way. So that's great to hear. And hopefully more people will hear this and want to apply. I wanted to just ask as well for folks who are maybe thinking about it. Are there some key qualifications or experiences that might make someone a good candidate for the program?
That's unique to each individual. A lot of our community members went to college and never really used their degrees. They either went into an occupation where their degree was not the sole requirement, or they might have become a homemaker and not really gone into the workforce after college. We want to show them that there is an opportunity to take the education that they've already received, tack on a few other prep classes, and give something new a try. And it might be something that they thought of, they dreamt of, or never even crossed their mind, and they want to give it a shot to see if it's something for them. I'm a second career person. I worked in the private sector for 25 years. I started to study to be a teacher and went off into the private sector and didn't come back to it until I was 40. So there's a place in this profession for everyone.
And as we said, a great need for that. And given your experience, you know, in this part of your second career as an educator and as an administrator, do you have a sense of why there is such a large shortage? Are there many underlying factors? I know there's not one specific reason, but are there some factors that are, you know, not attracting people to the profession?
I think there are a lot of factors, but I think the other thing is a misunderstanding of what the profession is and what the profession offers. And the only way to find that out is actually look into doing it. And we're hoping at this information center to answer some of those questions. Talk about salary, talk about benefits, talk about requirements and what would be needed towards certification. We're hoping that those individuals that express interest will be teamed up with the school district in which they live. So we have all of the school districts in Sullivan County supporting this effort. And if there is an individual that lives in Sullivan West, we're going to hook them up with Sullivan West because there are opportunities for them to work as daily substitutes and full-time substitutes in our local school districts while they're looking to get the certification that they need.
And also at the informational session on June 4th at Sullivan BOCES at 5, you'll talk about some of those things as well as tuition funding opportunities. I wanted to point out that those opportunities could be available for folks that are interested as well, right?
Yep, and Mount St. Mary is looking to offer a reduced tuition, but this review of what they would need if somebody wants to go to one of our public universities, they're going to have the option to do that as well. It's just to get the information, to get them on the road. We have partnered also with Sullivan County Workforce Development to get the word out within our communities. And we're also working with them to look at possible ways to help fund those that are interested in going on to be a teacher.
All right. Let's remind folks again about where they can take that survey and get more information.
Okay, the information session is June 4th, 5 o'clock, Sullivan BOCES at 15 Sullivan Avenue in Liberty, New York. The information can be found on our website, www.sebocies.org, and it's also available on the social media and websites of most of the school districts in Sullivan County. If somebody would like to get a hard copy of it sent to them, they can call 845-295-4016 and request that a copy either be sent to them digitally or sent a hard copy.
Superintendent of Sullivan BOCES, Dr. Robert DeFore. Dr. DeFore, thank you for joining us. And this is a very clever and needed idea. So congratulations on that and good luck with getting some more aspiring educators.
Thank you so much, Tim. Have a good day.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Choi Commons. It's a cooperative of Asian-led farms in the Hudson Valley. We'll learn more after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Hello. If you're a book reader, and even if you're not, I'd like to invite you to join me, Aaron Hicklin, every Sunday at noon for Shelf Life on WJFF Radio Catskill, a show about books and the people who love them. Each episode, my guest picks two of their favorite books. I read them, and then we get together to talk about them. That's Shelf Life on Sundays at noon on WJFF Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. May is Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Today, we're spotlighting Choi Commons. It's a cooperative of Asian-led farms in the Hudson Valley that runs community programs, cultural events, and a wholesale food program designed to provide affordable, nutritious food for Asian American communities in the Northeast. Radio Catskill reporter Marin Scotton spoke to Larry Tsai and Amanda Wong of Choi Commons about their mission.
Farming can be a lonely career. After farming for 10 years, Larry C. was feeling just that, isolated. As an Asian farmer in a predominantly white farming community, he wanted to connect with others from a similar background. So he started Choi Commons, a cooperative of Asian-led farms.
I think, you know, it's fair to say that the young farmer community is very predominantly white and predominantly comes from a middle class background, right? Like this generation of people who are interested in farming and nothing against them, right? I'm glad that there are lots of young farmers out here, but they all come from a fairly privileged background and come from a very white background. You know, there are very few Asian farms in the Hudson Valley. I mean, you could pretty much, you know, all of each other, right? When you're up here, it's pretty, it's a small community. And so I had farmed in the Hudson Valley for a couple of years without really finding that community. And, you know, while I'm glad to have people around me, you know, and I farmed on a piece of land where, you know, it was a group of young farmers that were farming together and helping each other and resource sharing. And that's great. But, you know, to find people who are from the same cultural background who can talk about the food that we want to grow and the food that we want to eat and talk about serving, you know, the communities that we come from, right? That's not really something that we can bond with other people about. And having the drive to really find new ways to serve our communities, I think that's something that you really, you know, you can only find with people of a similar background. But really formed Choi Commons as just a part of trying to look for Asian community in the Hudson Valley and trying to find a way for us all to work together because it's lonely, you know, farming. And so this was really a way for us to kind of gather the people who were from our community in all different parts of the Hudson Valley and even New York City and see how we could work together on a project. We were really excited to form this group because it brings us together and it brings us together in service of mutual aid of each mm-hmm. other's operations, of each other's livelihoods and of serving the communities that we come from, that our parents are from, that have really brought us to where we are today.
Amanda Wong, the owner of Starroot Farms, started farming in 2017. Similarly to C, she wanted to connect with other Asian American farmers in the Hudson Valley. Doing so through Choi Commons has completely changed her perspective on growing food.
I never thought I would even be in a community with other farmers who looked like me, or even other people of color farmers, like back in 2017, which wasn't even that long ago. So I'm just like, which is really sad, but it's also really amazing, like the way I feel we've been able to position ourselves and work together and like stand for like this type of lifestyle and like be kind of like part of like the larger hope is that, you know, like the alienation and isolation that we experience won't be a part of everyone's experience as farmers after us. And like, I'm really hoping to make BIPOC agrarianism like a supportive, sustainable way of life that like currently definitely doesn't exist. And yeah, I think I feel like really similarly with Larry, where before I started doing kind of like mutual aid work and being mission based, that, you know, white, like most farming is done by white people for other white people. Mm-hmm. And that I felt super disconnected from all of the places that the food I was helping to grow was going to. And that felt super problematic. Mm-hmm. That, you know, like people that are food as like, you know, like the best quality vegetable only went to the highest bidder. And like, how can we operate in this world and not acknowledge that all of the like injustices and lack of, just like lack of equity,
mm-hmm.
That is so inherent in our food system. And yeah, I just feel like my luck and the way I spiritually feel is so different now that I'm like get to talk, be friends with Larry and Christina and Nicole and Kaya, and that we get to work together and build together.
Troy Commons is made up of three separate farms and operates a variety of programs. They focus on growing ancestral foods for Asian communities in New York City and redistributing resources to those in need. Prior to starting Troy Commons, both C and Wong felt a disconnect from the food they were growing and who they were growing it for. They designed their wholesale food program to provide affordable, culturally appropriate foods to the communities they came from.
Well, I think like the best thing is that we get to grow heritage products, heritage crops, and that people really enjoy them. And that I feel like the majority, probably like 80 or 90% of wholesale this year is going to distribution, like mutual aid distributions in Sunset Park and cool. East Harlem, New York, and different Chinatowns, and like having direct connections with mutual aid groups that are also Asian focused has been so like, it's been really supportive, and it kind of just feels like a reciprocal relationship versus like one that's purely transactional.
You know, our communities in New York City have always built their own supply chains, right? They've always been ignored by traditional supply chains because they don't have the produce and the vegetables that our communities need and want to grow and cook. And so what we're doing is just kind of a continuation of that tradition, right? That these farms, you know, Star Route and Toy Division, and Gentle Time, you know, they don't fit neatly into the distribution model, right? Mm-hmm. Like we have different needs as small farms and as hand scale farms. We have different price requirements and we have a different clientele. And so what we're building with the wholesale program is just a brand new supply chain from the ground up that is meant to serve these farms at this scale and for our communities, you know, not just restaurants, right? But also mutual aid groups, but also food pantries, right? That we're helping build these farms businesses, but also building our communities at the same time. Something that, you know, you're not going to see that with a distributor, right? That this is really, really creating a distribution channel with a social mission.
Alongside the wholesale food program, connecting with community is a big priority for Troy Commons.
You know, in service of trying to bring more people out to the farm, and this is really, this comes out of a program that we were running our first year as Troy Commons, where we work with Asian Americans for Equality and brought elders from our community in Chinatown and East Harlem to Troy Division in Orange County for farm days. And so you know, this really was to create that bridge between two generations, right? Between our elders and you know, young farmers today. You know, this is agriculture is something that is really important to the people in our community. And for our elders who have come to America, you know, they may have not, a lot of them have not been to a farm, you know, the entire time they've been here. I mean, there are some elders who haven't even left the city. And so, I mean, when you talk about like really powerful moments for us, I mean, that was really for me, just proof that what we're doing, you know, is making a difference, right? That you could see the joy in our elders' faces when they like came out and saw, you know, like Chinese green stem cauliflower being grown for the first time. Right. And telling us how they used to grow it back in China, you know, before they left.
My dad was at the event and he was just like, he's from Chinatown, grew up on Elizabeth Street, like grew up like hopping rooftops to go home because it was too dangerous for him to walk home. And he was just like, what you guys are doing are things that me and my friends always wanted to do for our people, but we couldn't, we could only fight for our people with violence. And like back in my day, I couldn't even be up on First Avenue and 12th Street. Like we couldn't even like be over here. So it's just, I think for our parents and like generations before us, I don't even think they could really even imagine that's like there's even a handful of Asian farmers in New York and a nonetheless group of people who are directly doing mutual aid work. And he's really proud of us.
Alongside sharing what they've built with their elders, Choi Commons wants to create a space where aspiring Asian American farmers feel welcome and can learn how to do things differently.
I think we want to show, you know, people who are looking at farming, to show young Asian people who are looking at farming in the Hudson Valley and even beyond, right? Not even just in New York and Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, you know, across the country, that this is a viable model, that you can really be in concert with your community, mm-hmm. that you can work outside the traditional bounds of capitalism, of just trying to find the highest bidder, right? And work together with people who share your values and create a viable business. You know, what we want to create, right, is to create a wholesale program that has the reliability of purchasing from anyone else, but, you know, is really serving not just the three farms that we have right now, but 10 farms, but 20 farms, and we're replicating this across the state, replicating this across the region.
That was Larry C. and Amanda Wong of Choi Commons. In Liberty, I'm Maren Scotton for Radio Catskill.
There's more information about the cooperative at choicommons.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, getting your own backyard garden going and more May programs featured at the Liberty Library. This is Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're talking to two of the funniest people I've ever met, comedians Ivy Lee and Dana Dute, about their ridiculous lives in food. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll start looking around for snacks. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's almost time to safely put out seedlings, and Tracy Gates is here from Liberty Public Library to tell us about the featured event at the library this month, a gardening workshop called Get Your Garden Going, plus more May events at the library. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Tim.
So garden time, it's almost time, and you've got a gardening workshop coming up Saturday, May 17th. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yes. I was excited to put this together because I am one of those gardeners that, even though I have lived up here for decades now, I just seem to like kind of get one in and then it falls apart. And anyway, I always, Are you one of those types too,
no,
Tim?
I'm not so much a gardener as I am like a weed whacker. I went in and tried to clean up our flower mm-hmm. garden, and yes. I was all excited after I did it, but now I'm kind of like, oh, right, I got to keep doing that.
Right, exactly. So, I know, that's
hopefully
that's
this will spark my enthusiasm. This is a longtime gardener, Rose Dash, giving us show and tell about how to successfully get your garden going yeah. and growing.
Yes.
What are some of the things she's going to talk about?
Yeah, so Rose, aptly named as well, lives over in Parksville, and she grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania, and she told me she had her own little patch down there that she and all of her siblings would garden in the summer and raise all sorts of vegetables and flowers and so forth. So, and then she did a stint in New York City for a while, and then she's been up here I believe since the early 2000s. And she keeps on adding to her garden. So, and she's super passionate about it. So, what is she going to cover? She is going to cover all sorts of things. And what's great is that I think this program will be great for both people like, me or that have dabbled in gardening, but people that are total beginners or people that just want to kind of add to their knowledge. And I think any gardener knows they can, it's trial and error, and listening to other people is always a good thing. So, she's going to talk about, the best location, for wherever a garden should be on your property, especially when when you're starting to think about like the leaves coming in and where the crops are as far as like that need sun or need shade or need a little bit of coolness. Then she's also going to talk about, the soil. We certainly know that there's a lot of rocks here in Sullivan County, and I feel like every right. year I'm picking them out.
Yeah.
So how to amend your soil, maybe how to get your soil tested when there are places around here that do that.
Will she talk about pests and pollinators?
Oh,
as
my
well?
Gosh. Yes. Yes, she will. Yes, we know that there's lots of, I mean, I hate to call them pests. I love those deer and bunnies and so forth, but they're not really good for your garden.
How about they're pesky?
They're pesky. They are pesky. And how to discourage them. I actually have a neighbor that plants a deer garden, so it'll stay.
It's specific. Oh, that's
exactly.
Smart.
So that's she's going to cover that, like how high you need that fence to be, because deer can jump pretty darn high.
So as well as demonstrating, will she also be answering some questions to help grow your green thumb?
Yes, for sure. There will be, she's got a lot of knowledge, so we're going to, pace it. And, certainly there's lots of time for questions and her to give answers. There'll probably be some other garden gurus in the group as well. So, well, maybe a discussion.
So it's Saturday, May 18th, mm-hmm. in the program room at the Liberty Library on Main Street in Liberty.
Yes.
Starts at 11. Mm-hmm. It's a free event, but you're asking for registration.
We are, you know, if you suddenly wake up Saturday and you want to come down, come on down. We put that registration in for that program because it's helpful to know like how she is going to bring some seedlings with her. And so we want to have enough for people. And she's got lots of seedlings. So it'll be fun for people to come and actually put those into their gardens.
You've got a healthy listing of teen and children's special events in May as well. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. You know, I do mostly the adult programming, but we've got a great leader of kids programming, Laura Little, there. And so I cannot take credit for these, but I did walk in. I worked a day that I don't normally work last week, and they were in the middle of an escape room.
Yes.
And
There's one tonight or today at 3:15 for grades 9 to 12. An escape room experience.
Yes. So, hey, if you're listening to this now and you want to, escape a room or figure out how to escape a room, come on down to the library at 3:15 and Laura will show you or give you clues on how to do this. But they were having so much fun doing it.
Also, there's a Dragon Craft for Kids Tuesday, May 14th. Mm-hmm. After school Legos, May 20th, and teen game day, May 29th. A great range of things for kids.
And we always have snacks and things like that. Yeah, exactly.
Just like Francis Lamb, love a snack. Let's talk a little bit about the ongoing programs, though, some of the ones that you're a little more involved with as well, those writing programs, there's the memoir writing workshop continues.
Yes. In fact, that is, well, I was going to say that is tomorrow at 2 p.m. That has become extremely popular and so much fun. I usually try to limit that to about 12 people, and we have it in our conference room. So it has a nice, you know, more intimate feel. So we've gathered people from all over the community, of different ages, and, I give people a prompt to work on at home, about something in their lives that they can write about. And then people bring in their writing and we read like 2 to 3 pages aloud. You don't have to, but everyone wants to. And what's great is that people are really encouraging, but also constructively critical. Everyone has really, really enjoyed it, including myself. I've kind of been blown away by the stories.
Yeah. And you've got a movie matinees that are happening as well. Yes. Are those targeted toward seniors or?
You know, they really aren't. It's, you know, the time is probably more of a time that retired people perhaps, but you know, people these days are working at different hours. So, and days. So they're Friday. So, and it's every other Friday. We've got one coming up, this Friday at 1 p.m. called Scrapper. And it was a winner of a grand jury prize at the Sundance Film Festival. It takes place in England. And, the reviews have been great. I am a huge, movie fan, and I like all sorts of things from big Hollywood blockbusters. At the end of the month, we're going to do, 2 Fridays in a row. We're going to do Dune on May 24th at 1 p.m. And then the next week, Dune Part 2. And I've read reviews that you have to see these films with people with a bigger screen. And we may not have the largest screen in the county, but we do. It's much bigger than my kind of big screen at home. And people love coming. We do. We have popcorn and some refreshments.
It's a nice time to do it, a matinee at 1 on Fridays.
So, yeah. You know. Yeah. Take, you know,
it's December Friday.
Exactly. So keep an eye out at, you know, we've got, I usually put the movies up a couple months in advance. And so you can take a look at libertypubliclibrary.org and look at the right at the top of the page. It says events. Click on that and you can see all of our programming, including what movies are coming up.
And before we go, you wanted to give a special shout out to Senior Swing.
Oh, my gosh. Senior Swing.
Not just for seniors anymore.
I can't even take real credit for at least the idea of it, because someone in our chair yoga group came up to me and said, you know, I've got a group of people that, seniors who really want to dance. And so I looked into it, and actually we've got it on our screen. We're using YouTube, and I'm finding like, we dance to ABBA, we dance to the Bee Gees, we dance to Bruce Springsteen, and, people love it. Love it. So I'm already thinking, let's have a quote unquote senior prom, you know, and go all out.
I love it. Oh, wow. So this, I mean, the works maybe.
I know it's in my head, and it's going to happen. It's going to happen. You can dress up. Hey, Tim, you should come on down. All right.
Listen, I love some ABBA and some Bee Gees. So Liberty Public Library is where you can find these events and more. It's at libertypubliclibrary.org. Our neighbors down the road, Tracy Gates.
Come on
from the
down
Liberty
and visit.
Public Library. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this episode, previous episodes, and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Juana Summers. We've got your back when it comes to reporting the news. And one of the things this station counts on to keep it all going, contributions.
Including that vehicle you no longer need. Donate it. Help us bring you the news you count on. Learn more by visiting this station's website. And thanks.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
How we make sense of the news and the world keeps changing. Who to trust and what's real are other moving targets. Let On the Media be your guide. Saturday afternoon at 4.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, clouds yielding to some sun with a thunderstorm in parts of the listening area. It'll be breezy, very warm, a high near 80. More clouds tonight, a low of 50. And tomorrow,